Without further ado, I'll turn it over to Bob Kuhn, the president of the University of British of Trinity Western University, who will give us a welcome as well as welcome the president of UBC.
It's my pleasure to welcome you again on behalf of Trinity Western University and its faculty and staff. It's my privilege to serve as the president of Trinity Western, not yet the president of UBC. Although I am a graduate, as is Arnold, of University of British Columbia, twice from an arts degree and as well a law degree. I'm pleased especially to welcome President Ono to our campus. Some of you may know he was elected a director of Universities Canada most recently, about 3 weeks ago, and we're proud of that fact from our British Columbia representation. Now, President Ono's and Trinity Western and UBC are not always friendly rivals, but they are nonetheless rivals. And despite our size, we play in the same team or same league as UBC does, U Sports. But I want to assure President Ono that this is not an adversarial environment and that he is welcome here. Certainly, whenever I visited him at UBC, he's been welcoming and warm. And on a personal level, I can say that he has distinguished himself as not just the president and an excellent president of the University of British Columbia after some times of less than stable or at least less than uncontroversial leadership there. And I've been pleased to meet him whenever the opportunity provides itself to be on his campus, so I'm pleased that he's here on this. I've experienced him both as a transparent leader and also a prolific Twitter user. I've never met a president of a university any president of a university or most anyone else who uses Twitter as effectively and as transparently as President Ono does. He's a leader who wears the robes of office with humility. He's a man of integrity who seeks to walk the talk when it comes to faith. And that's, these days, seemingly a rarer and rarer accommodation. So again, welcome to Trinity Western, and I trust the conference will continue to be a great success. Thank you.
Well, in this morning of switching roles, it's my privilege to address you in my first day as president of Trinity Western University. It's really great to be here. Langley is absolutely beautiful, and I've been looking forward to seeing this campus. I've heard so many great things about it, and we have quite a few students from UBC that are from this area. Including one you may or may not have heard of called Michael Pratt, who's about to graduate, who's running for city council here in Langley. And I know that the students at UBC from Langley and from this area simply love the setting. And those that know the school know that it's a very special place, including my friends, the Chan family, and others who have sent their kids here and have told me about how it is a really supportive environment for young Christians and those who are searching. I want to thank you, Bob, and Arnold. Where's Arnold? There you are. For your kind introduction and for giving me this opportunity to speak with you about something which is near and dear to me and obviously with your attendance here important to you as well. And that has to do with the intersection of science and faith. As you heard, I was born to a father who is still a mathematician, who was then at UBC, and he was not a Christian for most of my life until relatively recently. So I did not grow up in a Christian family. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my journey and my thinking about science and faith and its compatibility. It's an honor and privilege to be with you today. As president of UBC, I am relatively frequently invited to speak at both public and private schools, both agnostic and Christian and multi-faith. within Canada and beyond our borders. I'm thrilled to have a chance to engage with so many of you from coast to coast, both north and south of the border and elsewhere, gathered here for this Canadian Scientific and Christian Affiliation Conference 2018. By the way, I found that devotional to be absolutely fascinating. And I was excited to hear about the perspectives of N.T. Wright. I've had a chance to serve with him on panels at InterVarsity. And also to hear about Francis Collins' address to the sister organization to this Canadian Scientific Conference, because he is someone who's thought quite a bit about the intersection of science and faith. I understand that this year marks CSCA's 45th year of exploring the challenges and insights at the intersection of science and Christian faith in Canada, and of being part of an international movement around the globe. And so nearly half a century of coming together and to think about these important questions. I want to really have a dialogue with you, so I think I've structured my time with you to give you some remarks, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. This morning I've been asked to speak about a topic that is very important to me personally, as I said. I think it's actually fundamental to all of God's people. It's fundamental because I've come to understand my own purpose in life over the years. And it's through that thinking that I've decided, as a scientist and someone who relatively late in my life found Jesus as my Savior, that my role is really to be a servant through all aspects of my life, to be a servant leader, and ironically, to be a servant leader in what is clearly a secular university, a university which is multi-faith. I certainly didn't start out imagining that one day I would ever be called a leader. I became an academic because of my natural curiosity and passion for science. And that passion and curiosity led me to an academic career in medicine and biology. Some of you may know I still have an active laboratory at the University of British Columbia. My research encompasses the immune system, the eye inflammation, and the leading cause of blindness, a condition called age-related macular degeneration. It's something that in the past decade there has been remarkable progress in understanding the biology and pathophysiology of the disease. Early detection and treatment can reduce vision loss, allow more people to enjoy their retirement years and to maintain their independence. And if you speak to many people and ask them of the senses that you have, which is the one that you hold most dear, and most people would say it's their vision, their ability to see their loved ones. You heard in the devotion about the speaker's children and how his wife, in homeschooling, encouraged their children to pay attention and to look around at the wonders of the diversity of what God has created. My own research is intellectually rewarding, and I am mindful of my responsibility to put all of my energies and that of my team to try to make true advances so that we can hopefully preserve vision for those that are affected with macular degeneration. As I progressed in my academic career, I also began to assume administrative and leadership responsibilities. Some would call it joining the dark side, if you are a faculty member. And it happened almost accidentally. It happened when I was a professor at the University College London, where I was still only interested in trying to understand genetics of the disease and to try to understand whether there might be something new, some aspect of science that would be uncovered through our experiments. And it was then that the provost and president of UCL, Malcolm Grant, invited me to serve on one committee and then yet another committee and yet another committee. And then, unbeknownst to me, I was moved to the dark side, as faculty members like to say. But I learned that I actually liked it, that it gave me an opportunity to try to make decisions that weren't focused on me, to try to think about things such as race equality at an institution that hadn't had a conversation about inclusion and diversity, to make decisions about how funding might actually be allocated, to make it possible for those less privileged to attend an institution that was considering the institution of top-up fees that would make the cost of attending UCL once a situation where people would actually receive grants to attend university to one where it would go to £9,000 a year. And so I decided that although it was viewed by many as being joining the dark side, that there was actually a responsibility and an opportunity to serve others through leadership positions in administration. Ultimately, I would return to North America to continue my research in the south of the United States at an institution called Emory University in Atlanta. And it was there that I was actually brought into the provost office, going even deeper into the administrative dark side. And I really enjoyed that because there I had a chance to launch initiatives that really made it possible for first-generation students to attend university for the first time. And then I was surprised after my time there to be invited to be the provost and then president of the University of Cincinnati, just prior to being invited to come back to my birthplace at UBC as president just almost 2 years ago. As I said, my leadership style is really, and it took me some time to arrive at this, focused on something called servant leadership. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that and how I arrived at that philosophy. It's my view that a leader has to start from a position of humility and respect for everyone in the organization. There are all kinds of people that you work with and encounter as a university president. In both of the universities that I've served, the University of Cincinnati with 45,000 students and about 10,000 faculty and staff, and the University of British Columbia now with almost 66,000 students and 16,000 faculty and staff, are really large towns or small cities, if you think about it, almost triple the size of Langley itself. Some of you are at UBC, and when I walk around Westbrook Village, which didn't exist when my father was a professor there, individuals will pull me aside and say, like it or not, you're the mayor of the University of British Columbia. And they'll say, why is there trash on the street? Why is the snow not plowed on the street? And so there is some truth to that. And with that comes an even greater sense of humility and respect for difficult decisions that need to be made. Servant leadership doesn't mean that you don't at times have to make tough decisions or to assert yourself. But the foundation of how I interact with people begins with one of mutual respect. You do have to say no sometimes, and you do have to make tough decisions, and you do have to assert yourself because there are finite resources, and you can't do everything that is asked of you. Part of how I reach out to the least powerful individuals in any organization or society comes from remembering what it feels like to be undervalued. The other part comes from my faith. As you know, I'm a Christian, and I've been very involved in churches in the different cities that I've lived in from the age of approximately 30. As Jesus says in Mark 10:45, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And if you think about that, if we hold that as sort of a value in everything that we do, then we can make society a much better place. And it becomes even more important if you're in a position of responsibility to do well for others. As a university president, my focus on service is agnostic of denomination or of faith, because I do serve a secular institution. It's really about my responsibility for others and focusing on them and on the wonders of the world that individuals in a university are able to participate in and to uncover through their scholarship and research. And so it's entirely consistent with my own faith that I can be supportive of all faith groups, and also of students who are still searching or have decided that there is no room at the moment for faith in their lives. And all I have to do is remember my childhood and my young adulthood and my transition into a believer to realize that they are only at one stage of their entire life, and they deserve support even though they have not found Christ yet. I still need to serve all of the individuals in the institution, regardless of what their belief or interests might be. And I can tell you that I think it makes me and those who search and those who believe in Christ stronger, actually, to be in a secular environment. And if you think about it, it's actually in that kind of a milieu that we can truly be evangelical. If we are in institutions where everyone is already a believer, then what is the delta that can be achieved? Certainly, you can make those who believe stronger Christians, and that is just as important as what can be accomplished in a secular institution. But the unique opportunity at a place like UBC is to interact with and to spread the good news to those who have not yet heard it. And I consider that to be a true honor and privilege. At UBC, there are about 24 student clubs that have a faith affiliation. I don't focus so much on the similarities and distinctions of the particulars of different religions. I honor and respect each of their beliefs. I focus more on the fact that for individuals that do have a faith, it's an important part of their identity. It's an important part of their wellness. It's an important part of who they are. And in respecting them, I must respect whatever their faith or lack thereof might be. For that reason, at a secular university, I can be supportive of very different kinds of people with different faiths and different beliefs, understanding that for each different group of people, there are different ways that are necessary to support them and for their wellness. Particularly poignant for me was when I was asked in the midst of Islamophobia about 1 year ago to join the Muslim Students Association as they prayed. Certainly, I stood at the back. It would not be appropriate for me to pray with them, not understanding even the basics of their faith. But I understood how important it was for them to feel accepted, to feel that they belong at the institution, in this province, in this nation. And therefore, I joined them, and I supported them. And it meant something to them. It made me think back to when I was a graduate student in Montreal at McGill University. I came, as you heard, from an agnostic family, a father and mother who came from Japan as immigrants And I remember as a child, as my neighbors and the families would go to church and go to something called Easter service and Christmas Eve service, not really understanding what it is that they were doing, living in a cocoon of total ignorance of what Jesus Christ was and the good news. As a graduate student, I was very focused on my research and my studies, and it took it hard at McGill when the research didn't go the way I had hoped. And as scientists, I'm sure many of you have been there, trying to get an experiment to work over and over again. But I was fortunate to run into two people. I ran into a pastor. I fell in love in Montreal, and my wife, still my wife, to be, brought me to her church, Westmount Baptist Church in Montreal. And I ran into a pastor, Lloyd Pierce, and he actually was my Sunday school teacher. There I was at the age of 21 with my fellow pupils that were 7, 8, or 9 years old. Lloyd Pierce at Sunday school reminded me not to take myself too seriously, even though I was 2 or 3 times older than my fellow classmates. And that advice has helped to keep me balanced and to be focused. And whenever I get stressed, I try to remember my time in Sunday school. I often remind students not to take themselves too seriously and to look after themselves. Doing well on exams is important, but being healthy mentally and physically is also important. But I'd like to give you a little bit more information about my faith journey and how I struggled about the intersection of science and faith. Being a scientist, studying biology at the University of Chicago, and then doing experimental research at McGill University, and coming from an agnostic family. It's a deeply personal story, as it is with everyone. It's not really unique. But it was one that I struggled with as I explored science and explored at early stages, faith. It certainly isn't a remarkable story in any way, as I said. In many ways, it wasn't meant to be. I think I owe it to God that I was able to find Jesus, and I will tell you how that came about. As I said, I was born in Vancouver at St. Paul's Hospital in 1962. Some years after my father and mother had emigrated to Japan, to North America, first to the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study. At that time, my father was a professor of mathematics, he is a number theorist, at UBC, in the same department with the amazing future president of UBC, Professor Walter Gage, who was also a member of that department. Some of you may remember him, a remarkable man. My mother and father were not believers, as I said, and did not practice any religion. From kindergarten through 12th grade, despite growing up in a predominantly white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant neighborhood, after Vancouver in Philadelphia, and then in Baltimore, where my father would move from UBC to be professor of math at Penn, and then Johns Hopkins, I had very little concept of what happened in churches. I thought they were beautiful. That's pretty much what I knew. I walked past them going to school. We drove past them on our way to different places. We learned how to play musical instruments, but I didn't really understand what was happening inside the churches. Every now and then, I would play my cello in a church. And so I thought maybe churches were recital halls planted around the neighborhood. The only times we as a family would enter churches would be to listen to music. My father loves music. And we would go there on Christmas Eve or to hear someone play in a church just because that's where the concerts happened to be. I didn't think that pews were very comfortable. I still don't. But I was curious about what actually happened on Sundays and on evenings and in afternoons because curiously, the parking lots were always full. These churches were really nodes of activity, places where people built community. In some ways, I was jealous of not being part of that mysterious activity happening in churches. But I thought that churches were community social clubs where people gathered on Sunday for coffee and where my friends attended Boy Scout group meetings. My first introduction to God and Jesus occurred in my freshman year as a student at the University of Chicago. With the sudden freedom of living far away from home and with no parental guidance, I slipped into a typical trap that perhaps some of you did as well, especially those of you who were boys. I partied hard and frequently drank too much on Friday nights and weekends. Please don't tell the students at UBC. Indeed, I think that part of my binge drinking had to do with a deep dissatisfaction with my life, deep inside my soul. Maybe a lack of a soul, really. A lack of spirit, of a spiritual anchor. However, I didn't know it at the time. I just knew that I wasn't very happy. There was one particularly risky evening when I had had far too much to drink and was hanging from an open windowsill on the fifth floor of my residence hall, Burton Judson Courts, on a very cold, dark night at the University of Chicago. I don't remember much about that evening other than that two of my friends rescued me from the windowsill and helped me get into bed, and they stayed with me all night long. It was a very difficult night, and as I said, they stayed there, but they did much more than stay with me that evening. And I'm sure that many of you have friends like that, that you owe your life to. These two friends were very active in church on campus and started to take me with them to church services on campus and elsewhere. We went to a chapel on campus called Bond Chapel, a Catholic chapel, and then to the larger church on the University of Chicago campus, Rockefeller Chapel. They took me to intervarsity groups, both large and small, and I was totally confused. It appeared as if people would get up and sing, and then they would read the Bible, something I had never read, and think about it and pray. They also took me back home to their suburbs to attend their churches, to meet with their ministers and mingle with their home congregations. In particular, they took me to their families, and they gave me love because they thought I needed love because they knew that I was lost. I remember feeling very special when entering these churches. I actually literally felt, and I still feel when I enter churches, chills going up and down my spine as I, for the first time, knelt down to pray, not understanding what that meant. Although I had virtually no knowledge of the Bible, there was something about simply being in those churches that moved me as I've never been moved before. And I feel exactly the same way today. After graduating from the University of Chicago, I made my way back to Canada to be a graduate student in experimental medicine at McGill University. As I said, my girlfriend from Chicago was meant to join me in Montreal, but she never ended up joining me. And I quickly spiraled, as some of you may know from my story, into a deep depression. I began drinking again, heavily, and had suicidal thoughts. Fortunately, I encountered a fellow graduate student working in a collaborator's laboratory at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal. She played the piano. I played the cello, and a flutist joined us one afternoon. The pianist's parents, both professors at McGill, left, and they were surprised when they returned that the flutist had departed, but the pianist and I, the cellist, were still there. And the pianist's name was Wendy Yip, my current wife. We started to date, and as I said, we're still happily married today with two young daughters. What's important with respect to this conference is that she, understanding that I had forayed into thinking about Christ, took me to her church, Westmount Baptist Church. I was a doubtful, smart aleck non-believer when I accompanied her to church, even though I had already those feelings, those chills down my back whenever I entered a church. We would spend hours talking about why I had problems believing in God and Jesus. I had been educated in my family and at the University of Chicago as a scientist. If you're a mathematician's child, you always look for a proof. And I could see no proof of the existence of God or Jesus. I know there's at least one mathematician here who knows exactly what I'm talking about. After many conversations and my attendance at Sunday school with 11 or 8 or 7-year-old kids, I started to understand the concept of faith and the persuasiveness of the Bible and the power of those who believed and the impact of belief on those individuals. As evidence, I eventually concluded that there must be a God. That particular pastor, Lloyd Pierce, of Westmount Baptist Church, worked with me and my faith emerged and grew stronger day by day. I'll never forget the day I was baptized in Westmount Baptist Church on a glorious, sunny Easter day, probably the most profound day of my entire life. Although my attendance at church would be variable, I became an even more committed Christian once my first daughter was born in Boston, Massachusetts. There was a pivotal moment when I was a senior vice provost for academic affairs at Emory University in Atlanta. Emory was originally a Methodist university, but is now a secular, multi-faith university. I discussed the issue of faith with the then president of the university, Jim Wagner, and also a Christian, and also with a professor of theology who I admire greatly and still admire, Tom Flynn, a retired Catholic priest who had joined the faculty of that university. President Wagner, a Presbyterian, was relatively open about his faith. But he reminded me that as a senior administrator, it was important for me to respect and support staff, faculty, and students of every faith, as well as those who had decided not to believe. Professor Flynn, on the other hand, was different, and I understand and respect his advice to me. Although he was a Catholic priest, he was extremely discreet about letting people know that he had been a priest. He was incredibly careful about letting others know, this at an institution that was early on Methodist, about his faith. He encouraged me to hide my Christianity and to be, as he said, quote unquote, a stealth Christian. And this from a Catholic priest. After more than a year of considering the possible options and what President Wagner and Professor Flynn were trying to say to me, and having conversations through InterVarsity's graduate faculty ministry that I tried to grow at that institution, and where we had conversations about the risks and dangers of being openly Christian in a secular institution, I made a decision, going against that advice, not to be a stealth Christian, because it ran counter to everything that I read in the Bible. In fact, I decided to immerse myself in supporting students of all faiths at Emory University, including Christian students, and Christian graduate students, and Christian junior faculty, and Christian full professors, because I saw and I believed that they needed support as well. I continued this practice at the University of Cincinnati and now at UBC as well. And as you know, there have been articles written about it in the Vancouver Sun and elsewhere, so it is no secret. I am not, and I will never be, a stealth Christian. Since moving to UBC, I have maintained my approach in supporting faculty, students, and staff in whatever faith they may practice, and regardless of whether they are believers or not. I also do not hide my Christianity, for a large proportion of our campus community, whether they are faculty, staff, students, or alumni, faith plays an important role in their identity and their wellness. And therefore, it is important for me to respect each of those faiths. It's important for me to be supportive of their needs and to advocate for them with respect to their needs on a secular campus, to fulfill that part of their identity and their well-being. There are multiple gifts that result from having a spiritual path, in my view. My own faith keeps me anchored and keeps me focused on why I am doing what I do and why I should use my efforts to help individuals in the university community and beyond. It's not just about becoming more esteemed. It's not about getting more grant money. It's not at the institutional level about becoming a higher ranked, even more globally respected institution, although those are not bad aims. The focus should always be to serve, whether we're individual faculty members, whether we're administrators, or whether you're looking at the institution as a whole. We have to remember the place that we have here in this earth and the opportunity that we have to use our gifts to serve all of God's creatures. I believe my spiritual path and philosophy of servant leadership are both very supportive of faith and science coexisting at a modern secular university. The tension, if you will, between science and faith is between science on the one hand, which is evidence-based or proven to whatever extent that's possible, and faith, on the other hand, which is something that transcends human understanding. You see, my arriving at my faith was really embracing the limits of human understanding, and understanding that with those limitations, some of the most profound tenets or philosophies cannot be proven. When we make the conscious decision to have a faith in a particular religion, whether based on indirect references in history or in the Bible or in some other foundational document, we take that leap of faith. What I want to talk to you about today is the journey that I took to understand the limitations of human understanding. It's really embedded in what was stated in the devotional today, in really immersing myself as a scientist into the complexities of not only the universe, but the complexities of a single cell, or the complexities of a single pathway, a biochemical pathway, or molecular pathway essential for life. You see, as a scientist, and also for other scientists such as Francis Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, the largest biomedical organization in the world, and, as was referenced earlier today, the author of the seminal book, DNA, The Language of God. You see, he's an American physician geneticist who discovered genes associated with a number of diseases and who played an important role in leading the Human Genome Project, at least the portion that was led in the United States. One of the most respected biomedical scientists of our generation. If you read his book, and you should if you haven't, his faith journey is a fascinating and inspiring story, and there are lots of parallels in how he arrived at resolving the tension between science and faith. A lot of parallels to my journey to that same conclusion. Like Francis Collins, I was trained as a scientist from my father to try to prove all things, QED, he used to say, to only make pronouncements about something being true because there's empirical data that supports that view or that statement. And I tried to remain true to that in my early years. However, what I learned was that one of the privileges of being a scientist is that you begin to understand the limitations of human consciousness and human conceptualization of things that transcend our ability to understand or explain or to prove. Reaching that point that required humility took some time. And when you work with students or faculty members that are at the same place, are still questioning, are still doubtful, you have to give them time to travel that journey as well, to understand through their own life experience that there are limitations to humans' ability to understand or to prove. Let me tell you about mine. I told you that my research focuses on how the eye works and how the immune system works. And some of the brightest people in the world that I've had a privilege to know have spent a lot of time trying to understand how those systems work. Systems of which there are many that make up what it means to be an organism or a human being. And the best of them admit they have only a partial understanding, only skimming the surface of understanding that system, that molecule, or that field, or that they admit fully understand the most fundamental aspects of those systems. Much of how the immune system works has been discovered in my lifetime, and it's truly remarkable. In witnessing with the front row seat how the immune system works, or what we understand of how the immune system works, I can tell you that I've realized it is so complicated, and there are so many checks and balances, and there are so many layers of complexity, that the very brightest of human beings that I've had the privilege of knowing and working alongside, the brightest of engineers, couldn't have engineered the immune system that is at the core of what it means to be a multicellular organism. As a scientist, the crux of my faith is learning firsthand that the tremendous diversity and complexity of biodiversity exists beyond the explanation of the brightest human beings I have known. Let me give you another example. I told you that I was a student at the University of Chicago, a truly wonderful institution. And I was at awe as a high school student and as a university student when I went to the chemistry department and I saw the dissertation of something which is really at the crux of the tension between science and faith and creation. At the University of Chicago, a very famous experiment was carried out called the Stanley Miller experiment. There was a great scientist there called Harold Urey, who had a graduate student called Stanley Miller. They conducted an experiment not that long ago, in 1953. It was an experiment that was designed to try to test whether creation could be recapitulated in the laboratory. Many of you probably know that experiment. And I was at awe that I could actually hold that dissertation, the actual dissertation signed by Harold Urey as a student at the University of Chicago. And what they tried to do was to simulate the hypothetical conditions present on the primordial Earth in order to test whether man could actually create what was described in Genesis, whether or not they could start to create complex molecules and maybe cells and processes. The experiment is considered to be the classic experiment on the origin of life. The experiment provides evidence that talks about something called abiogenesis, the theory that under the proper conditions, hypothetical conditions simulated in their experiment, that life can actually arise spontaneously from non-living molecules. But if you actually look at it, and people have actually gone back and looked at and analyzed the products of that experiment even more recently after much time. The molecules produced were simple organic molecules, far from a complete living biochemical system, far, far away from even a single biomolecular process. After hundreds of replications and modifications using techniques similar to those employed in the original Miller-Urey experiment, with all the knowledge that we have as scientists, scientists are only able to produce small amounts of less than half of the 20 amino acids required for life. That's all that we can do. We can do other things. There's been some advances like polymerase chain reaction. You can create nucleotide primers and you can create reactions. But these are all harnessing things that stem from the ability to produce recombinant molecules and to take advantage of things that already exist in nature and to add them back. But if you try to simulate the primordial Earth, you can't get very far. Evolution alone cannot explain how we got, in my view, from a few amino acids, 10, to the remarkable complexity of a molecular process, far from the complexity of a cell, far from the complexity of a multicellular organism, far from the miracle of a human being, ability able to think about very complicated issues and to develop ideas and philosophies. And from my perspective, far from even the basics of how the immune system works. See, I started my faith journey with a very closed mind, thinking that the only things that could be true are those things that could be proven. The deeper I delved into experimental science, the more I appreciated that so much that exists in this world that cannot be explained, and so much exists in the world that cannot be proven. Not only did this realization open my mind, it was the pivotal force that was really the foundation for my faith. My view of science changed when I became a Christian. In turn, my view of religion changed, and changes regularly because I'm an active, questioning scientist. To give you some examples, being a scientist pushes me to think about the Bible and whether the stories in the Bible are literal or figurative. And my faith influences how I think about data, how I think about potential flaws in data, and how I think we have to be very careful in how we interpret data as a scientist. Thus, I don't feel a tension between the secular university and my faith. All of the different views and questions and conundrums that are explored in a university for me underscore and strengthen my faith. As Jesus says in Matthew 22:37, love the Lord thy God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. That phrase, with all your mind, invites us to welcome discourse and dialogue and difficult questions in our spiritual life. Through questioning our faith, I believe that we become stronger individuals. For me, a real gift of the spiritual path is that you grow as an individual and your faith becomes stronger because you're constantly asking yourself questions and perhaps sometimes doubting your decisions. This is really at the heart of what it means to innovate. How do we welcome innovation in our spiritual lives? There are churches and congregations where there is active debate and sometimes tension between different members of the congregation or the denomination or different parts of the congregation and the minister. We've all been there. And we know the tensions that exist within single denominations. And some people don't want to be in that kind of environment. They want to be in a happy church where everyone agrees and things aren't questioned. But I believe that those aren't the strongest churches. I believe that the strongest churches are like the strongest universities, places where people feel safe to question, to debate, and to have active debate. We really need to come to believe when our faith is challenged, and we work through inconsistencies and differences of opinion. In the same way, the best universities are the ones where people have the freedom to voice different points of view and to either change their mind or strengthen their belief based upon honest discourse, to explore the questions and mysteries of science and faith together, and to acknowledge the humility of what we don't know. In closing, I'd like to once more say how honored I am to be here and how excited I am to share my faith with you. I think what I've learned in my journey is that God is everywhere, not only in church, where I still feel those chills when I walk into church, not only here today, but God is everywhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And I'm a fellow sort of cell biologist that looks at molecular pathways. So it's good for me. I wanted to actually kind of go back to your comment about supporting all faiths in the secular environment, which is great. But what about those that are lost? They don't have any at all. I as you know, mental health is a really huge problem for our young people today. And we're seeing this even more with international students, graduate students, when their experiments don't work, right? So is there, you know, we often look to UBC to help us, give us leadership and advice about research and things like that. Is there something that Trinity could do for you in terms of how do you reach out to the lost?
Well, I'm sure there are many things that we can learn from Trinity. UBC is a wonderful institution, but we don't have all the solutions. We don't do everything right. And I'm sure there are many things that we can learn. I'd love to learn more about the support programs that exist here at this institution. I can tell you that although I've only been at UBC for 2 years, I try to do the best that I can to support each of the faith groups on campus. I can't speak too specifically about this right now. Some of you may know that in addition to my duties on campus, I connect with many of the churches of different denominations and faiths around metropolitan Vancouver as well. And I know through those interactions that many of them very much want to be there for the students and faculty and staff of the university. I want to encourage them to look at ways that they can connect with our community, perhaps move closer to campus. I don't think that, to be honest, that we have sufficient faith groups on campus. When I go to many of the churches around campus, there isn't great attendance. And even the churches that exist, for example, Origin Church that exists on campus, on a good day, we'll only have 100 or 150 students, and we have living on campus now about 13,000 students, and in apartments around campus, we have over 22,000 students. So, when you look at all the churches in Point Grey, and the faith groups on campus where they meet, either on Sunday or in the evening during the weekday, the number is very, very small. And I know in talking to students and faculty and staff that many of them crave to have a spiritual home. So I have no illusion that their faith needs are attended to, those who are searching, and certainly there's a lot of need for those who are lost. You know, there are a number of faith-based groups, for example, Navigators and InterVarsity, that are working on campus. But I think that even though UBC is a secular institution, I've worked at many secular universities, that we could have a more robust supportive system so that those who are lost, those who are searching, have a spiritual home. Absolutely.
With that, let's thank Dr. Ono once again.
Thank you very much.